Well, good morning. This is Jeff Blankford. Welcome you to the June 11th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. When the heads of the two major intelligence committees criticized the Obama administration on Sunday for swapping Sergeant Bo Bergdahl for five members of the Taliban, they honed in on one part of the deal that the White House has struggled for a week unsuccessfully to explain. The question is why the five were released without any commitments to a larger agreement under which the Taliban would renounce international terrorism and begin a process of reconciliation with the government of Iran, the government of Afghanistan, end quote. Well, that's how David Sanger and Matthew Rosenberg of the New York Times began their Monday's update of the ongoing controversy surrounding the recent prisoner trade. It illustrates how the mainstream media is, in 2014, no less wedded to Washington's official narrative of what happened in 2001 and the aftermath of 9/11 than it was when it first beat the drum for invading Afghanistan and then Iraq, during which Times reporters were among the most culpable. At no time does anyone in the national media remind us that whatever theory one has about the origin of the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, not even the White House accused the Taliban of having had a hand in it. Those who followed the events at the time recalled that in the aftermath of the attacks on 9/11, the Taliban offered to turn over Osama bin Laden to the U.S., asking only that Washington provide evidence that he was involved in the attacks. Not only did the Bush-Cheney administration ignore the offer, 13 years later, the evidence of bin Laden's involvement in 9/11 is still yet to be produced, and though five men said to have been members of al-Qaeda have been charged with planning the attacks and are still being held in Guantanamo, none has been brought to trial. The fact of the matter is that whatever else the Afghan Taliban may be, and most of which I'm aware of isn't pretty, its members have not committed acts of terror outside of its borders nor attacked the United States. The suggestion that it has, and consequently must renounce international terrorism, is in keeping with the efforts by Washington, first by George W. Bush and afterwards by Obama, to conflate the actions of al-Qaeda, which had been based in Afghanistan, with that of the Afghan Taliban, which until the U.S. decided that a regime change in Kabul was a priority, was recognized as the country's legitimate government. On June 3rd, the British Independent's Patrick Coburn wrote how a number of emails that then-Private Bo Bergdahl had sent home to his parents before leaving his base, and which had been published in Rolling Stone, revealed the extent of the U.S. failure in Afghanistan. At 20 minutes past the hour, I had hoped to be speaking with Patrick Coburn about that subject, the implications of the Bergdahl-Taliban exchange, and what it says about America's longest war, but I just learned before going on the air that Patrick's paper, The Independent, has asked him to rush a story immediately out on the capture of Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's hometown, by the Sunni militants of the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant. And so I persuaded him to give us 10 minutes and talk about that. In any case, nothing exposes America's failure in Afghanistan more than its massive failure to control the cultivation of opium poppies, the major source of the world's heroin supply. No, I should rephrase that. Nothing exposes America's perfidious role in Afghanistan more than its being directly responsible for the reemergence of Afghanistan as the world's leading producer of opium. Some of you may remember that earlier in 2001, Secretary of State Colin Powell paid the Taliban a mere $43 million to suppress Afghanistan's infamous opium poppy crop, the major source of the world's heroin supply, and they actually succeeded in doing that. As the New York Times' Barbara Croisset reported on May 21, 2001, quote, "The first American narcotics experts to go to Afghanistan under Taliban rule have concluded that the movement's ban on opium poppy cultivation appears to have wiped out, the world's largest crop in less than a year," officials said today. The American findings, she wrote, confirm early reports from the United Nations Drug Control Program that Afghanistan, which supplied about three-quarters of the world's opium and most of the heroin reaching Europe, had ended poppy planting in one season. End quote. Today, as a direct result of U.S. intervention, the opium poppy crop is at all-time record levels, and the Taliban apparently is among its beneficiaries. On April 30th, writing in The Guardian of London, Spencer Ackerman pointed out that, quote, opium cultivation is estimated to be at an all-time high in Afghanistan, despite the U.S. spending $7.5 billion to combat it. A report by Washington's Afghanistan War Watchdog, he said, has found the billions spent by the state and defense departments on counter-narcotics since 2002 has been for naught. Opium poppy cultivation, he noted, takes up 516,230 acres of land in Afghanistan, a 36% increase since 2012. Drug use inside Afghanistan has spiked, according to the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, with an estimated 1.3 million Afghan adults out of a population of 32 million being regular drug users in 2012, up from 1 million in 2009. About three-quarters of the world's illicit opium products originate from Afghanistan, with its cultivation concentrated almost entirely in the country's southern and western provinces. Is it just a coincidence that it was in those areas, particularly Helmand and Kandahar provinces, where the bulk of American and British forces were deployed during the 2010-2012 troop surge? Well, a lot of comments can be made about that. I'll be asking for some of yours later. In Iraq, site of another unprovoked criminal war, the evidence of American failure is even more demonstrable. Already the scene of almost daily suicide and car bombs that in this year so far have taken the lives of at least 4,500 people as the country faces an attempted takeover by ISIS, English acronym for the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or some call it the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, a Sunni militia that emerged in Syria in the fight to overthrow the regime of Bashar al-Assad and can best be described as al-Qaeda on steroids. Yesterday, as part of its continuing campaign to create an Islamic Sunni caliphate across the region, ISIS overran Mosul, Iraq's second-largest city, as Iraqi army soldiers abandoned their weapons and fled, and today they have taken to Crete. That allowed the Sunni militants in Mosul to free hundreds of prisoners and seize military bases, police stations, banks, the airport, and the provincial governor's headquarters. The attacks widened the Sunni insurgency in Iraq and were among the most audacious assaults on the government since the American military withdrawal more than 2 years ago. The rout in Mosul, an important center of the country's petroleum industry, was described by reporters on the scene to have been breathtaking in its speed and appeared to take government officials and residents of the city by surprise. Besides being a major humiliation for the government forces in Iraq, Sunni-dominated areas, the defeat reflected the strength of the Sunni insurgency, which has gained battle experience and has been growing since joining opposition forces in neighboring Syria. Meanwhile, in Syria, the carnage continues. Patrick Coburn has been there, and he commented on that as well in another article. It has been a good week, he wrote, for those who like their hypocrisy neat and straight from the bottle. There was U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry condemning the Syrian presidential election in which Bashar al-Assad was reelected for a third time against nominal opposition, quote, as a great big zero, end quote. But at the same time, Coburn writes, the U.S. and Britain said they were officially looking forward to working with President-elect Abdel Fattah al-Sisi in Egypt, who is turning out to be somewhat of a comical figure who cannot even fix an election properly. Despite an official holiday, free transport, massive media support, religious encouragement, and the threat of $70 fines for non-voters, polling booths in Egypt remain stubbornly empty or underused. Of course, the hypocrisy does not end there, notes Coburn. For all his triumphalism over the turnout in Syria, Assad's way of dealing with parts of Syria not under his control is to shell them and drop barrel bombs on them. Nor is the opposition much better when it comes to targeting civilians, except that its means of destruction are much less than that of the state, end quote. Coburn didn't offer further comments on that on the vote, but it would seem from the massive turnout of Syrian refugees at the Syrian embassies in Beirut and Amman that the overwhelming majority of the Syrian people prefer the devil they know or have known, Assad, to the Islamic jihadists who are demanding a Middle East under Sharia law. On the Israeli-Palestinian front, the Israelis have expressed their disgust with the fact that their key allies, beginning with the United States, are not following Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's directive that they should have nothing to do with a so-called unity government made up of what is being described as Palestinian technocrats who have no affiliation either to Fatah, the ruling party of the Palestinian Authority, or to Hamas. The U.S. Congress, as could be expected, is siding with Netanyahu, who has called for the U.S. to cease funding the Palestinian Authority, but there is something disingenuous about the whole matter, since Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas has assured Israelis and the Americans that they will continue making decisions for the new government, and that the Palestinian, quote-unquote, preventive security police would continue to suppress Palestinian resistance to Israel's continued occupation. A member of Hamas's former government in Gaza has claimed on his Facebook page, yes, they do Facebook pages, that Abbas is only making those promises to trick the Americans while saying something quite different in his meetings with Hamas. If anyone's being tricked, it is the Palestinians who think that Abbas represents them or their concerns, and those naive souls in the international peace community who believe the same thing despite mountains of evidence that Abbas has been and remains a collaborator with the Israeli government. To make that point, on Sunday, Palestinian Authority security forces arrested 16 Hamas supporters on the West Bank and issued summons to seven others, a Hamas spokesman said Sunday. As the unity government prepares to enter its second week, those political detentions threaten to drive a wedge between Hamas and the Fatah-led PLO. The arrest came just days after the unity government was inaugurated in Ramallah. Among a dozen Hamas members detained in Nablus, two were teenagers, 16 and 17. The other arrest took place in Ramallah and Hebron. The Palestinian Authority also sent summons for interrogation to seven other Hamas supporters across the West Bank. On the Russian-Ukrainian front, the business pages tell a different story than what the Obama administration and its NATO allies would like us to see. Yesterday's New York Times business section carried a photograph of David Campbell, head of BP's Russia operations, shaking hands with Igor Sechin, president of Russia's state energy company Rosneft, after the two men signed a preliminary agreement last month to study shale oil deposits. Looking on and clapping his hands was Russian President Vladimir Putin. Sechin, it should be noted, is one of the Russians in Putin's immediate circle who's been sanctioned by Washington. At the same time, Neil Duffin, Exxon's head of exploration, also signed an agreement with Sechin to expand its joint ventures to drill offshore in the Arctic Ocean, to explore for shale oil in Siberia, and to cooperate on a liquefied natural gas plant in Vladivostok. Despite the push by Western governments to isolate Moscow for what the Times reported described as, quote, its aggression in Ukraine, end quote, energy giants are deepening their relationships with Russian companies by striking deals and plowing more money into the country. Along with Exxon and BP of Britain, France's Total also signed contracts at the business forum in St. Petersburg to explore for shale oil in Russia. Exxon plans to drill its first exploratory well offshore in the Russian sector of the Arctic Ocean this summer. State Oil of Norway is in talks for another shale oil venture. Royal Dutch Shell's chief executive, Ben van Beurden, met with Mr. Putin in April and told him, quote, now is the time to expand, referring to a liquefied natural gas plant project. The companies are taking a calculated risk given the threat of further sanctions, noted the Times reporters, but they also wanted to protect their long-term interest in Russia, the world's largest energy-exporting nation, end quote. Well, that's not exactly a sentiment to bring smiles to the faces of either Obama, his NATO allies, or the neocons who helped orchestrate the coup in Ukraine. But then neither is it something that those who are committed to stopping the galloping pace of global warming should cheer about. Meanwhile, on Monday, NATO launched one of its largest military maneuvers in the Baltic states since tensions spiked with neighboring Russia over its annexation of Crimea following February's coup in Ukraine. Around 4,700 troops and 800 military vehicles from 10 countries, including Britain, Canada, and the United States, participated in what was called the Sabre Strike exercises near the Latvian capital of Riga. Ignoring Russia's understandable objections to the maneuvers, they continued yesterday in neighboring Lithuania. Finally, a rare piece of wonderful news from the Good Riddance to Bad Rubbish Department. Yesterday, as you've heard by now, Republican House Whip Eric Cantor suffered one of the most humiliating and most deserved political defeats in modern times when he lost his reelection bid in the Virginia Republican primary to a Libertarian opponent who he had outspent 20-1. The winner, with Tea Party backing, was a little-known economics professor, David Bratt, who had never held elective office. The race wasn't even close. The Associated Press called it for Bratt shortly after 8 p.m., an hour after polls closed, when he was leading Cantor 56% to 44%, with 80% of the precincts reported, and that's pretty much how it ended. Cantor should have been removed from Congress in 2010 after announcing on his website that he had met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in New York after that year's midterm election and had promised Netanyahu, the head of a foreign country, that he would block any effort on the part of Obama to put pressure on Israel. Well, that, unless you were listening back in 2010 when I reported it, I'm sure you have never heard. Cantor's defeat is definitely a cause for celebration.